Okay, we are in Revelation chapter 4, starting with some information that we introduced last week. This is Revelation 4, verses 7 and 8. And the first creature was like a lion, and the second creature like a calf or an ox, and the third creature had a face as of a man, and the fourth creature was like a flying eagle. And the four living creatures, having each of them six wings, are full of eyes round about and within. They have no rest day and night, saying, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God the Almighty, who was, and who is, and who is to come." Now, we talked about the fact that these creatures, need no rest. Day and night are not there in heaven. That is an expression to describe, eternity, if you will, continuous action. And then we kind of left off with the holy, holy, holy. Some people see in that expression a reference to the Godhead. I don't think that's probably what John had in mind. I do think, though, there is a definite emphasis on holiness. And as we look at these four creatures here in Revelation 4, 7, and 8, you begin to, I think, see that they pay a lot of attention to God's holiness. It's almost like they are the guardians of His holiness. And as they look at God, His holiness, they look at man and his sin, they have a good understanding that those two things can't go together unless something is done. And I think in eternity, not only these creatures will have an understanding of that, but humanity will also be able to come to that same comprehension that sin, unless it's dealt with, cannot be in God's presence. And then you also have these creatures offering their testimony about God's eternal nature. They said He what? He was. He existed in the past. He is present tense. And He or will or shall be. He's going to continue. Now, can you imagine the significance of that for these readers? If you're in the first century, what was the big nation that was in power?
Rome.
And it would have looked like Rome was always going to be there, right? Well, if you saw some of the pictures from VBS, what about ancient Rome? It's in the dust. It went down. And, we would like to think that America will be here forever and ever, but, there's no guarantee of that. 50 years, 100 years, if the world is still here, this nation may not exist, or at least it may not exist in the form that we now have it. But in spite of earthly nations not continuing to exist, God's been in the past. He is in the presence, and He's always going to be. So this was an important lesson for these people and an important lesson for us. Now, the four creatures are really where we left off last week. And there have been a lot of ideas proposed about these creatures. If you're just joining us, Revelation 4, verses 7 and 8 is where we are. You have these creatures described under six different figures, and some have said, and I think this is probably the best illustration, man. One of the creatures looked like a man, and that, of course, would seem to represent God's creation, humanity, that's the head of the earthly creation. The lion, what would he seem to represent as we think about the lion? All right, you think about the wild animals. He's king of the jungle. So you think about the wild animals, that would certainly be a fitting representation for him. The calf, which I think is probably better rendered ox, what would he represent? Got an ox out in the backyard. Well, probably not most of us, but why would you have an ox? All right, strength. And unlike the lion, what's the ox? All right, he's going to be that tame, he's going to be that domesticated animal, whereas the lion, with his great strength, he's going to be on the wild side of things. The ox is going to be the tame, domesticated one. And then we come to the last one, the eagle. What comes to mind there? All right, we think about freedom, this great bird, and four great categories as far as, when we think about our world. Now, it's kind of interesting to me, if you were to go back to Genesis chapter 9, and I'll read this for us. Genesis 9, verse 10, you see basically the same four categories early in the book of Genesis. And with every living creature that is with you, that would be with man, the birds, the cattle, that would be the domesticated stuff, and every beast, that would be the wild animals of the earth with you. So even in Genesis 9:10, you have these four basic divisions. And then, of course, this is going to tie into also what we see a little bit later in Revelation 5, Revelation chapter 5, verse 11. Now, when we think about these creatures and our earth, we have how many directions on earth? Four, right? North, south, east, west. All right, four directions, four creatures. There may be some additional symbolism here that you've got four creatures, whichever, not literally speaking, but figuratively speaking, whichever direction has something that's associated with God's will. God says, I've got a servant for that. Whether it's over here, or back there, God said we're covered. We do not have to worry about being short of folks. And these creatures, these four creatures in Revelation 4, stand ready to do whatever God's will requires. All right, now, we've kind of talked about what they may represent. Let's spend some time talking about whether or not we can determine what they actually are. Some have the idea that these are actually some of God's attributes. I don't think that's right, because as you look at verses 8 and 9, Revelation 4, these creatures actually offer praise. So that would suggest to me that we're not dealing with something like God's qualities, but we're actually dealing with some kind of creature. Some have thought, well, what we have here, four pictures of Jesus. You know, Matthew talks about Jesus from the perspective of a lion. Mark's going to look at him as like an ox-like servant. Luke looks at him as a perfect man. And then, of course, in John, he's the divine Son of God. I don't think that's right. Then you have some other wild views with premillennialists. You'll see this. Some would say, well, the nation of England, that's represented by the lion. And we've got Africa, it's represented by the ox. Asia symbolizes the face of the man. America is represented by the eagle. Well, that's an interesting and colorful explanation, but I still don't think that's right. Don?
The same terminology used in Ezekiel.
Right. Ezekiel 1 and Ezekiel 10. And if you go back and you look at those references in Ezekiel, you'll find that Ezekiel, specifically as he talks about these creatures, he uses the word cherubim. And when you compare Ezekiel 1 and Ezekiel 10 with Ezekiel 4, the information lines up very, very well. So I can't say with 100% certainty that we're dealing with cherubim here in Revelation 4, but it seems to me Ezekiel 1 verses 5 to 25, if you want to look at these references a little later on your own, and also Ezekiel 10 verses 1 through 20, there are some striking parallels. Now if you study about cherubim, you find that they are what I might refer to as God's enforcement angels. When it comes time to carrying out some kind of discipline, or when it comes time to enforce something, then it seems like the cherubim show up. Now, you will, if you study Ezekiel 1, find something that is a little different than what we have here in Revelation 4. Ezekiel 1 verse 6, Ezekiel, as he pictures these cherubim, he says, and remember, we're still dealing with figurative language. We're talking about symbols, and you don't want to read too much into the symbol, because the symbol represents something. But the imagery in Ezekiel 1 says that each of these cherubim had four faces. Now, that's kind of difficult for us to imagine. When we think about a face, we think about, one face. I'm looking at Steve, and, he's just got one face. But, if I were looking at Steve, and I would say, okay, one section of him looks like an eagle, another section looks like a man, another section looks like an ox, another section, looks like another animal. I mean, we'd say that's kind of hard to imagine. But John, he uses a lot of the same information. But he says, he describes them as having only one face. I don't know that that is proof that we're not dealing with cherubim. But when you look at the book of Revelation, John sometimes, I might say, streamlines some things. He simplifies some things. And that very well could be the case here. Daniel did a similar thing. Daniel talks about a beast in Daniel 7. John in Revelation 17 also talks about this beast, but he simplifies it. So I think a similar thing could be done with the cherubim. Now let's run a few, let's see. Anything that you want to add or ask before we run a couple cross-references? Lois?
Your reference in chapter 5, Ezekiel 5. What was?
No, Ezekiel 1.
Oh, Ezekiel 1.
Uh-huh, verses 5. To 25.
Oh, 5 to 25.
Uh-huh. Sorry about that. Ezekiel 1, 5 to 25, and then from chapter 10, start at verse 1 and go down through verse 20. And like I say, we're not going to sort through all that in class, but you can have those cross-references for later. Anything else before we look at some cross-references on cherubim? Now, these are some fascinating creatures, and I wish we had a little more information about them. But let's look at the information that we do have, because you might be surprised at the details that the Scriptures give us. We start with Psalms. Psalm 80, verse 1. Let's get somebody lined up for that. Psalm 80, verse 1. Who wants to be a helper? All right, Dolores. And after that, we're going to go back to the book of Exodus, chapter 25, verses 17 and 18. Exodus 25, verses 17 and 18. Lois, and that's going to be Lois Craw. And then we'll also look at Exodus, chapter 26, verse 1. Steve, Exodus 26, verse 1, and then from 2 Samuel, chapter 22. 2 Samuel 22, verse 11. All right, Lois, and that's going to be Lois Beeson. All right, let's begin with Psalm 80, verse 1.
Hear us, O shepherd of Israel, you who lead Joseph like a flock, you who sit enthroned between the cherubim, shine forth.
All right. You have here a reference to cherubim. That's clear from the text. You have God pictured on his throne, and what's it sound like these cherubim do, or where are they?
They're surrounding him.
I might use the word flanking him. Just like a military officer, a general or maybe a colonel might be flanked by military officers, not that he really needs them, but it's a sign of importance. They're an aide if he chooses to use them. So these cherubim seem to flank God's throne. And John pictures four of them in Revelation chapter 4. Don?
I'm trying to visualize what you're talking about, cherubim and their enforcers. Now, I understand them being at the gates of the guard of Eden. Nobody went in there.
Right.
So there. But is there a need for enforcers in heaven?
Well, you think about, for example, Acts 5, Ananias and Sapphira. You have their case. Or Acts 12, Herod is struck dead. God did not need anyone or anything. God could have immediately said, okay, you're going to die, and bang, with my power, you're dead. If he can raise the dead, he certainly can cause people to leave this life.
Okay. I guess I'll
What they do, now that we're past the first century, I do not know. I do not know. But it does seem that their role as far as being, if you will, protectors of God's holiness, and I say that not indicating that God needs a protector of his holiness. But as I said before, you sometimes have a military officer that's flanked by people as a sign of, respect and power and position. It seems like they serve in this particular way. And they're, you remember the statements in the Old Testament where God said, I'm a jealous God. It almost seems like these cherubim are the same kind of thing. I mean, they are tasked. Sometimes people can be absolutely focused on something. They just become almost obsessed with it. And the picture I get from the cherubim is that they are very, very focused on God's holiness. They do not want anything to threaten that or to interfere with that. So I would imagine their role has changed throughout time. There's no longer the Garden of Eden. They're no longer doing that. It would appear that they're no longer doing the kind of thing that we find in Acts 5 and Acts 12. So the role has definitely shifted throughout time. But exactly what that role is today, I don't know. But the purpose of cherubim would seem to be still consistent. I don't know, but it would seem like there was, in Acts 12, for example, the Bible says an angel of the Lord smote him. Now, which angel was that? I don't know. Would it make sense to me that a cherubim who is an enforcer, if you will, did that? Yes, it would. Could another angel have done it? Certainly. But I'm just saying that you do have a definite statement there that somebody died at the hand of an angel. And we do know that, cherubim seem to fit into this particular category, so very well could have been one of them, or maybe all of them, for all I know. But they are these special servants. All right, Stan.
Wasn't it the cherubim that overshadowed with their wings the Ark of the Covenant?
Very good, and that's where we are. That'll bring us to our next reference, Exodus 25, verses 17 and 18. Let's look at that. Exodus 25, 17 and 18.
And you shall make a mercy seat of pure gold, 2.5 cubits long and 1.5 cubits wide. And you shall make 2 cherubim of gold, make them of hammered work at the 2 ends of the mercy seat.
Okay, so here you've got the ark. And you've got the mercy seat on the ark. And then on each end, what do you have? You've got the cherubim. This is the holy place for God when it comes to people under the Old Testament. And the cherubim, why? Are they just there to, look on and say, well, hey, this is kind of interesting? No, they're there to, once again, represent what? This is a holy place. And we are here to, if you will, guard it. We're not going to let anything interfere with God's holiness. So you have that in the Old Testament era, the book of Genesis, when we talk about the Garden of Eden. They're flanking God, Psalm 80, verse 1. And now you find them here at the Ark of the Covenant. Now, I think a lot of people are basically familiar with these two references, but what we might not be so familiar with is these cherubim were also embroidered on the veil that separated the holy place from the most holy place. Remember that? There was just like this giant curtain, holy place inside, the most holy place inside, the holy place out here, and there's this giant curtain. Now, this brings us to Exodus 26, verse 1.
Moreover, you shall make the tabernacle with 10 curtains of fine woven linen, blue, purple, and scarlet thread. with artistic designs of cherubim you shall weave them.
Ah, now isn't that interesting? On this great veil, or on this great covering, cherubim were there. Well, now that would make sense, wouldn't it? If they are the protectors of God's holiness, if they're the watch people, if you will, that are there to go ahead and do that, they are there guarding not only the ark, but, you know, the entrance to the most holy place. Okay, 2 Samuel 22, verse 11, and this will give us some insight about their one of their abilities. Okay, now, you think God needs any kind of transportation? No. But it says he rode on the cherubim. What's that indicating to us? You know, God needs to go somewhere, figuratively speaking. You think he wants to, you know, head down the road in an Amish buggy, about 10 miles an hour? God says, when it's time to go, I need to be there, right? So if you're riding on the cherubim, what's it mean? God says, choo. So when we think about these creatures, what would we conclude as far as their speed?
Very fast.
They're very, very fast. And I would understand that to mean really instantaneous, wherever they need to be. Now, Ezekiel also seems to pick up on this in Ezekiel chapter 1. And once again, you can read through it, Ezekiel 1 verse 16. And in that 10th chapter, Ezekiel 10 verses 9, 10, and verse 13, 2. And Ezekiel's imagery is a little more complicated. I saw a guy try to draw it out one time, and he did a pretty good job. But unless you're just a real creative and great artist, it'll drive you nuts. But the cherubim, he pictures them as being attached to wheels. Now, John doesn't use that imagery. He strips that away. Once again, I think for his purposes, he's trying to simplify things. But that wheel imagery would be consistent with what we find in 2 Samuel 22. These cherubim are very, very speedy. Now, having said all this, we want to make one other quick point before we look at Revelation 4, verses 9 through 11. When we look at mankind on the earth today, does man often think that he's the center of things?
Yes.
I'd say so. Especially in America, life revolves around me. Life revolves around us. But when we start looking at Revelation chapter 4 and Revelation chapter 5, the Bible says, hey guys, guess what? There's somebody we can't see. He's on the throne. And we may not recognize it right now, but life, existence revolves around him. And when we look at life, man's really offered a choice. You can either primarily serve self and honor self, or you can choose to really do your best to serve God. And the information in Revelation 4 as well as Revelation 5 tells us that we want to put God first in our lives. If these creatures, these cherubim, these mighty angels are focused on God, then what about us, the lesser? That should certainly be true of us as we go through our lives. And we have that option of having a close connection with deity through the church in this life, and then, of course, having that greatly enhanced in eternity. Anything that you might ever ask before we look at verses 9 and 11, 9 to 11, Revelation 4. Don?
You've addressed night and day, and never cease to say. Is that literal?
Once again, I think you have to look at the information and say, okay, is this literal or is this a picture that's trying to tell us something? And my understanding of that would be a picture. Not that, you know, we talk about 24/7, and if that were literal, the convenience store is open 24/7, literally whenever you go there. I don't think that's probably the point. But it is that they're completely focused on this. You know, praise is definitely offered. I would say it's offered on a regular basis. But these people, or these creatures, are, if you will, jealous for God's holy. I mean, they are very, very focused on that. And I didn't mention this earlier, but I will make this point now. We sometimes have the idea, or sometimes people will tell us, well, God can do whatever he wants. And we think that God is going to let so-and-so into heaven. Well, if you've got the cherubim up there, guess what? If these folks are the enforcers and they are jealous about God's holiness, this is a holy God. How much unrighteousness gets to, you know, to him? Zero.
I don't think God himself will.
Right, I agree. And like I said, God doesn't need any help. But we have this additional imagery to suggest, hey, there are some servants that are really focused on God's holiness. So if we can just kind of forget about God for a second and just think about the servants, anybody going to get past them? No. And if you're not going to get past the servants, you're certainly not going to get past God, as Bonnie mentioned. So when we think about heaven, we talk about in our songs, you know, it's made for the pure and the free. We're not kidding when we sing those songs. And these creatures show us that it is going to be a holy, holy environment. And, you know, if we're not kind of headed in, if we're not headed in that way, we're not going to make it.
The sinner gives to God, doesn't he? The prayer of the sinner?
Okay. When we talk about a sinner, I'm assuming that we're dealing with a person who's accountable for his sins, but not a Christian.
Right.
Oh, okay. All right. That individual obviously can pray. He has that ability. I mean, anybody can pray. Child can pray. Does God hear that in the sense that he knows the words that are said? Well, if he knows all things, then he would certainly know what that individual is saying. So in that particular sense, that prayer would make it to God. You know, if God is aware of sin, when you know what evil people do, then he's obviously going to be aware that, you know, people say various things, perhaps even a prayer. Is a prayer going to make it to God in the sense that it's going to be responded to in a favorable way? The answer to that question is no. You know, we think about prayer in the Bible. Peter, remember in 1 Peter 3, he talked about husbands. He says that your prayers, treat your wife in the right way. That your prayers be not hindered. Now that tells me something about prayer. Maybe the word scale is the wrong way, but you know, you can almost compare prayer to a scale. There are some folks who are living in the right way, and what's that do to their prayer? It's just like the guy that's out at the fair, and he's over there trying to ring the bell. I mean, bang, he slams it, and up it goes. And there are some other fellows, you know, that are doing some things in their life that their prayers, you know, there's some knots in their prayers. And, you know, it has a difficult time getting up there to God, if you will, figuratively speaking. And then there are some other folks that they don't even get it off the ground because of their life.
He does hear the prayer of repentance.
He is aware of what's said. Yes, I would say here in that particular sense. Okay, we've exhausted our comments. All right, Revelation 4, verses 9 through 11. We'll finish out the chapter. And when the living creatures shall give glory and honor and thanks to him that sitteth on the throne, that sitteth on the throne, to him that liveth forever and ever, the 24 elders shall fall down before him that sitteth on the throne, and shall worship him that liveth forever and ever, and shall cast their crowns before the throne, saying, Worthy art thou, our Lord and our God, to receive the glory and honor and power, for thou didst create all things, and because of thy will were created. All right, God is worthy of worship. That was something that John understood. That was something that's emphasized in this particular point. And the people who are his people, the people who profess to love him, worship is something that they are to do. The living creatures, and we've talked about them as far as what they might be. I'm inclined to think that they are cherubim. Certainly it seems like they are members of a high angelic order. They offer glory. That would be a way of describing praise. They offer honor. That would be a way of describing high respect. And they offer thanks, appreciation, thanksgiving to God. Now, as you look carefully at verse 11, you get a clue as far as what this praise involves. The praise is really directed at creation. And I think that's important. When we look at our world today, people say, well, yeah, stuff exists, but why? It all evolved, right? Evolution is the big thing. It just kind of, we don't know where it all started, and it's just, you know, we've got this eternal matter, which doesn't make sense from a common sense point or a scientific standpoint, but, you know, all this stuff just, you know, kind of amazingly came together, the human body and the animals and the planet that we live on and, you know, the water that we have and everything, but these creatures understand that God created all things, and even as they look at man and the earth, they say what? Praise God. You know, you are a glorious, you are a great, great God. Isn't it interesting that heavenly creatures can figure that out, the people on the earth can't? It's kind of odd. It's really ironic. And I think you also have here implied that not only perhaps are they looking at the earth as far as creation, but they seem to have a pretty good view of, you know, what's happened with man as far as sin. Especially in Revelation chapter 5, we're going to see there's some information about Jesus. He's the slain lamb and so forth. And angels, and I base this on Luke 15:10. Remember, angels appear to be watching things that happen. Ephesians 3 talks about that as well. They appear to be watching. And Jesus said in Luke 15:10, when one who's a Christian has left and comes back, what do the angels do? There's more rejoicing over the one that returns than the 99 that never left. All right, so you have apparently the angels praising God for creation, but also, I think, for man's redemption. They're able to look at what happened on the earth, that God creates this great planet. Man falls into sin. And I think if I were watching this great event unfold, I'd be wondering, is God going to wipe them all off the earth? And are we going to see a new creation? And it's kind of like God says, here's chapter 2, or here's chapter 3. I've got a plan. Peter talked about, things that angels wanted to peer into. So as they were able to go ahead and begin to see this plan unfold, certainly a reason to go ahead and glorify and honor God and give thanks. Then in verse 10, John says these people, these elders did what? They took their crowns and they cast them before the throne. You think they didn't like them? I mean, you got a crown of gold and you start throwing it around the room. That doesn't sound like you appreciate it very much. All right, reverence, appreciation, submission. I mean, you got the crown. You're a pretty important person, aren't you? Especially a gold crown. And when you take it off, you have the image of somebody bowing before someone, submissiveness, obedience, all of those things. And God is being praised, glory, honor, power, because He created all things. Now, if you saw the Vacation Bible School videos, I think this was the second to the last night. Remember the image? The fella, the tour guide, is leading the folks to an area that was formerly a pagan temple, and he passes by a waterfall. Anybody remember what he did when he came to that waterfall? Stop and got a drink. And the other people who were with him, they thought, well, hey, that's a pretty cool idea. Let's stop and get a drink. They just thought that he was, thirsty. And they thought, well, hey, it's a hot day. It's refreshing. And he gets up to the temple area and he says, hey, you remember what we did back there? He said, do you know why I did it? Anybody remember from the video why he did that?
The water came.
All right. He said, for us, and this is true even in our culture, most of us had some water this morning, didn't we? We got showered or, we mixed it up for some coffee or something. Anybody think that, where did you think that water came from?
Boston.
Oh, all right. It came from the city of Middlebury or Bristol or Goshen or, came from my well. Or it came from that particular town. But if you were living in the ancient culture, like we saw in the video, and you see this water, and some of these places were structured. You've got this big pagan temple and maybe this throne. It would almost be like a fountain today. And from the fountain or from the throne comes water, and you're hot. The people were taught, hey, that water that you're getting, that refreshing water, is coming from where? It's coming from Apollo. It's coming from Athena. It's coming from Zeus. It's coming from this pagan deity. But the angels, these cherubim, say God created what? All things. When you go and you get that refreshing water that you need, when you're able to go out and work in the ground and get the crops that you need, you can trace some of that back to the seed company for your carrots and your cucumbers and the other stuff that you planted, but ultimately it goes back to God, the one who is on the throne. So this was an important thing. Another thing, and this wasn't brought out in the videos, but I think it's probably useful here. These people would have been familiar with public appearances of an emperor. He would come, sit in the throne, and have a lot of people, crowds and friends, advisors, attendants, and representatives would be sent to him. Sometimes they'd be dressed in white to greet him. And then, of course, he would present golden crowns, and they would, toss those down to recognize his sovereignty and so forth. Again, that may be part of the imagery that John's trying to describe here. Then you have, too, I think, a statement that probably lends itself to life in the first century. The expression, our Lord and our God, that was a title that was also used by the Roman Emperor Domitian to go ahead and say, hey, this is who I am, and basically I want the honor of being thought of as God. So this is one of the themes that we see in the book of Revelation, and it certainly, I think, is introduced at this particular point. Those who become Christians need to recognize God for what He's done. Remember Matthew 5, verse 45, Jesus said, God sends His rain on the just as well as the unjust. So you don't have to be a Christian or someone who's in a right relationship with God, in other words, a young person who's not accountable for his sins, to receive those things. But praise God for what He's done in the past, for what He does now, and for what He's going to do in the future. The end of verse 11. In the King James, it reads a little differently, I think, than what you probably heard from the ASV. And it says, and for thy pleasure they are and were created. Now that makes it sound like, God just made all this stuff, man and the earth, to make Him happy. But really, I think the idea there is that all of these things, came into existence by God's will. It was his plan. And John actually uses two different tenses in the original text. He uses a tense which describes action, just like this, and then he uses another tense which describes ongoing action. And that indicates to me that when we think about creation, that's expressed by that instant tense. He created all things. And then after that creation, it's kind of like anything else. You know, you buy a house. Okay, we signed the papers today. But now what do you have to do for the next 30 years if you live there? Not only pay the mortgage, but you've got to keep it up. You know, you just don't do it one time and it just kind of goes on autopilot. And that's what God has done with the world. He created it and that was great. But unlike the pagan gods in the first century that supposedly were involved in the creation of various things and then walked away, God has not done that. He continues to exist. One commentator made this point as far as commenting on God's worthiness and praising him, and I think it's a great point. He said, we praise everything else under the sun, that is, everything else except God. And he said, we couldn't do worse in praising God. We praise people for their business sense, we praise our own intellect, we gaze adoringly at our own achievements. He says, and this is the really good part of the quote, he said, we are like pigs eating the acorns and refusing to look up. Now that's a good point. Because a lot of times, you know, people get involved in praising this and honoring this and exalting this. But really the one that needs to be praised and exalted is God. But far too often people do not do that. Don?
This may sound like a stupid question. It's not stupid for me to when I ask it. But when we get to heaven, we have power of reasoning and willpower here on earth, right? Mm-hmm. In heaven, we will not have willpower or power of reasoning. We have blindfold vision, blindfold mentality.
Well, I think when you look at heaven, you have a couple of things there. Logic and reasoning would still seem to be in existence. People, for example, the angels, going back to them in Luke 15:10, they can rejoice. Now that to me, for rejoicing, people can be kind of squirrely, so this may not be the best way to state this. But generally, if a person is going to rejoice, isn't there a reason for it? Can't you say rejoicing is the conclusion? There was A, there was B, therefore rejoicing. I got good news. This is something that I was waiting for. This is something that really matters to me. Therefore, logically, I have a basis to rejoice. Now, if the angels are rejoicing in heaven, I can't imagine that that is devoid or absent of reasoning. It would seem to me that they're able to, you know, reason things out. And then too, unless our knowledge of God is not going to be expanded beyond what we die with. And for a lot of people, I mean, you think about the folks who died even before the law of Moses, their knowledge of God compared to what we have with the New Testament. You know, they didn't know about Jesus. How are they going to be able to put the pieces together, if you will, unless they're able to reason? So it seemed to me that you have the ability to reason. Now, if you have the ability to reason, we're headed off the reservation a little bit here as far as some suppositions. But when we think about reasoning, we know that in life we can either reason correctly, or we can reason in a way that's partly correct, or we can reason in a way that's fully wrong. Now, in heaven, what kind of reasoning do you think the people will have? You think it'll be possible to draw false conclusions in heaven? I don't think so. What about partially incorrect reasoning? I don't think so. And when you go back, Don, and you begin to see what we talked about in last week's class, as far as the stones that are used to describe God, the two stones that were on the breastplate of the high priest, you see this rainbow, the sea of glass, the other stuff that we're going to see in Revelation chapter 5. My thinking is that it's going to be so overwhelming that people are going to say, I can't imagine that we would have made any other choice. And we don't want to be anywhere else. If we can imagine a state of, you know, perfection, let's put it in a form of an illustration that's not perfect, but, you know, maybe it'll help us. Let's suppose that next month it's 130 degrees outside. One of the hottest days the Midwest has ever experienced. And we have the choice of going out there and sitting in the direct sun and saying, ah, what a great day. Or we have the choice of sitting in an air-conditioned house with every possible luxury. Who's going to choose to sit out there on the 130-degree day and get sunburned?
hates air conditioning.
Oh, well, so you take, all right, let's say it's a 200 degree day, okay? All right? Let's say it's 200 degrees. You know, who's going to take the 200 degree day? Nobody is. Nobody is. Because we look at it and say, we can't even think about that. Because this is such a glorious environment. So there I think you have the process of reasoning intact, that it could not be any better. This is what we've longed for. This is what we hope for. This is what we've striven for. We've got the crown. We're here with Christ and God. The other choice is a devil. And I can't even see that thought is going to enter into the mind, Don. So that's my take on that.
Don't you think, too, a lot of the reason that we have to reasoning here on earth is because our daily things that are around us,
yeah,
all of our little worries, all of our little concerns, that's why we have to use so much reasoning here. We're in heaven, everything is already provided and taken care of. We don't have our tent pegs put down in here,
right,
like we do here.
Yeah. Well, Abraham seems to have, you know, he looked for that city that was afar off. One of the reasons was, you know, these things that I've got to struggle with and figure out how we're going to pay the bills, how we're going to raise the kids, how we're going to deal, you know, with this issue in the marriage, how we're going to take care of this issue on the job. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And John actually talks about a little bit later in this book, they're able to rest from their labors, which I would include the reasoning in that. You know, we've seen some passages in the past from the book of Ecclesiastes that said we leave that stuff behind. You know, that's just for life on earth. So exactly right. Okay, let's introduce Revelation 5. Revelation 5, verse 1. And I saw in the right hand of him that sat on the throne a book written within and on the back, closed sealed with seven seals. All right, now in our English Bibles, this is a new chapter. If you were to look at the original text, you would find that it just says and. It's just a continuation. So we appreciate chapter divisions. They are oftentimes very, very helpful. But even though we have here a chapter division, don't put too much stock in that, because it really is a continuation of John's thought. All right, here John speaks of him that sat on the throne. That is obviously a reference to deity. We're not told that it's a specific member of the Godhead. I'm inclined to think that we're dealing with God the Father. All right, and then John speaks of deities, which hand?
Right
hand. Now, once again, you have to, this book is distinct from Matthew through Jude in that when we look at Matthew through Jude, we're looking at the words and we're treating it as a document like we would, you know, get as far as an email, you know, literally understood, unless there's a figurative reason to go ahead and, understand it in a non-literal way. But here we've got a book where we have symbols, images, and pictures. And we have to take those symbols and pictures and images and sort of decipher them. Does God really have a hand? No. He's spirit. Remember John 4:24. So, you know, not literally God standing up there. He's not literally sitting on a throne. He's not literally, you know, got his right hand out. But John sees this as far as an image, a picture, a vision. All right, what does that image or vision indicate? Right? That should be the first clue. The right hand, the place of, that would be one word. Anything else?
Glory.
All right, that would be another word.
Power.
Power, another word.
God.
All right, God, and I'm going to include authority too. All of those things. So when you think about the right hand, the place of prominence and importance. All right, John says in the right hand there was a
book.
Think it looked like this? All right, there were no books like we have today. What would the books have been? All right, they would have been scrolls. And if you were in the VBS class, you saw that. It was kind of like a two-handled thing, and you've got a bunch of paper, then you could kind of unroll it, and then, you know, roll it back this way, and that way you could, you know, roll to the place where you needed to be. There are some ancient Roman sculptures that are kind of interesting because they show Roman emperors holding the kind of scroll, that seems to be described here, and that, of course, would have symbolized their power and their authority. And then, too, and this is also true in our day and time, anybody send out a letter last week?
Email.
Oh, well. That wasn't quite the letter that I had in mind. All right, a few of us did, or we've sent it out at least once in our lifetime. All right, before you send that letter out in the mail, you not only stamp it, but what do?
Address it.
Well, thanks, Jeff. That's true. That still isn't the answer I want. What do you do?
Seal it.
You seal it. That's what we want from Revelation 5:1. You're right. But we seal it. What's that seal? It's designed to do a couple things. But what's the seal do?
Secures it.
All right, it secures it. I mean, so the contents aren't going to come out, but, you know, there's sometimes some things that you just don't want people to read. So it's got to be addressed, but then it's sealed. Well, in this day and time, the sealing was a little bit different than our situation. I mean, we've got the nice lick it or just peel the paper and stick it approach. But in this day and time, people would go ahead and, you know, close up a document, and then they would melt some wax and then put blobs of wax on the document. And then they would usually have, you know, a ring, a signet ring, that would have, you've seen like the family crest, or they would have some kind of special insignia, and then they'd go ahead and, you know, dip it in that particular wax. Well, you know, once the seal's been broken, then you know that somebody's been in the document. And it would be virtually impossible to go ahead and replicate that seal. Those rings were very, very distinctive. So that's what John is describing here. Original documents were sealed. Copies generally were not. And in this particular case, the seal was sealed with how many seals?
Seven.
Now, we've seen before, Revelation, when you begin to see some numbers, you want to kind of go back and think, okay, we've got a number. Is that a number that we should maybe associate with some symbolism? And in this particular case, seven means complete. Perfect, full, entire, all of those connotations. And as you look at this document, it would seem to indicate some kind of important heavenly business. You also have the statement that the scroll had writing where? It was both sides, inside and out. Now, if you go back and you look at the Ten Commandments, Exodus 32, verses 15 and 16, John may have had that in mind, or the vision may have tried to kind of bring that to mind, because the Ten Commandments, you've got writing on both the front and the back of the stones. Here, when you say, hey, it's written inside and outside, I think once again you've got some symbolism there. What's it saying? Oh, all right. I think both of those things. Length, gravity. It's a document that's got a lot of information. So when we think about the heavenly business, there is, you know, a lot of information in this particular thing. I'm not going to give you that information. When you think about the word sealed, I think there are a couple of things that come to mind from that. This is sealed. When God says this is sealed, that may indicate a couple of things. Number one might be secrecy.
Complete.
All right, it's going to be complete. And the other thing I think might be that the information must come to pass. All right, we're not told what is inside this book, but we're going to have to pick up there next week. We've got some kids coming in. Thank you very much.